will now come to orders, 3:20 on March 7th. With us are Representative Miller, Holmes, Thompson, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. If you have a cell phone or BlackBerry, please turn it off. We've had problems with the equipment in the past. We've got three bills today. We're going to start out with House Bill 87, antitrust violations. And with us, come on up to the table. We have James Waldo, staff to Representative Holmes. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is James R. Waldo, and I'm staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes.
James, before you get started, we have a CS in the packet that has been out to the members and the public for well over a week, I believe. And I'd entertain a motion from Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt CS for House Bill number 8727-LS0331-I as our working document.
Assuming no objections, we'll adopt the amendment. We now have the CS before us as the working document. James, please identify yourself for the record, and I think we all know your affiliation.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Holmes. HB 87, and specifically the CS that the committee is now looking at, deals with updating the penalties for antitrust violations in Alaska. And, yes, sir?
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
Again, James R. Waldo, staff to Rep. Holmes.
This is good news or bad news. I don't know.
I'd like the record to also reflect we've been joined by Speaker Chenault. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 87 updates the penalties for antitrust violations in Alaska. Currently, the penalties for an antitrust violation for a natural person is $20,000 maximum, and for an organization is a $50,000 maximum. And that's roughly the cost of a somewhat expensive car. So what HB 87 would do is increase those penalties to larger levels, to $1 million for a natural person or $50 million for an organization, maximum. And again, those are maximums. So the court can say anywhere from zero to $1 million for a person, that's a natural person or an individual, zero to $50 million for any organization. And just for context, what the feds have in place for antitrust violations are $1 million for individuals and $100 million for organizations or companies. So we would definitely be not quite as high as what the feds have, but we would certainly be high enough to provide a deterrent for anybody who might think of engaging in antitrust violations. And the bill is actually broken down into two sections. The first section deals with sort of the criminal antitrust violations and would make the penalties, again, $1 million for an individual and $50 million for an organization, and makes it a C felony, which sort of brings it in line with antitrust violations around the country.
I'd like to, for the two members that came in late, we've adopted the CS that's in your packet. We're on the CS, not the the original version.
And
sorry, James.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Actually, segues perfectly with where I was going next. Section 2 is the new addition to the bill that came with the CS. And what Section 2 adds is it allows the Attorney General's office to seek civil penalties for certain antitrust violations that are listed there. And those civil penalties would fall right in line with what the criminal penalties would be. And it just sort of is an extra tool in the toolbox for the Department of Law when they're pursuing antitrust violations. As a side note, they haven't done that very often, but it just makes it available to them in case this comes up. And with that, if you have any questions, I would happily answer them. I believe we are going to have Ed Sniffen on the line, and he is the real expert here. And as you know well, our office has worked very closely with him in crafting the bill that we see before us so that it gives him the appropriate tools to do his job.
And I might add, Representative Holmes and I were working with Ed Sniffen on developing this. and with other people in the building, too, for that matter. But Ed, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation, and do you care to testify, or you just want questions, or both?
I could offer some brief testimony if that's all right with your chair.
Perfect.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Ed Smith, and I'm an assistant attorney general with the Attorney General's Office here in Anchorage. And my duties include the enforcement of Alaska's consumer protection and antitrust statutes. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for hearing this bill. As James stated, we've been working with the legislature to update our antitrust statute to include a civil penalty provision, and the CS before the committee does exactly that. Currently, there is no civil penalty provision in our antitrust statute, which is a little unusual. Most states do have a civil penalty provision. Our current penalty provision is a criminal one only, and as you know, criminal violations are much more difficult to establish. You need to prove those violations with proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've been involved in a couple of multi-state cases, particularly pharmaceutical cases, where we have brought antitrust actions with a lot of other states. And when it comes time to settle those actions, states with the strongest penalty legislation end up with more of the money because they can justify that. And in Alaska, we've made good arguments and have done okay, but it would have been nice to have had some stronger authority so we could have argued for a bigger piece of the pie. So that's one of the reasons why I have asked some legislators to consider this legislation. I've been working with them because I think it definitely will help us obtain better results in some of the cases that we've been working on. The amounts, as James said, are, I think, on the high side from what most states currently have in their statutes. They're lower than the federal statute. The federal statute was actually amended, I think, back in 2007 to increase their penalties, $10 million for individuals, $100 million for others. And since then, I know that other states I've spoken with, and I can't tell you which ones those are, I apologize, but they have been considering amendments to their statutes. I think in your packet of information, you might have a chart that I put together just last week. I sent an informal survey around to a group of assistant AGs who do antitrust enforcement in the different states and asked them for their penalty statutes. And this is what I got back. And when I mentioned to them that our bill was contemplating a $1 million, $50 million penalty regime, most of them were jealous and were hoping they could amend their statutes to be more in line with the federal statute as well. So we would definitely be on the front on this, though. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has. And again, thank you for hearing this bill.
We don't see anybody raising.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming, and James or Mr. Sniffen, you can whoever knows the answer to this. The only penalties that I see in here are, deal with, I guess, fines. Not more than a year is the only imprisonment possibility. I'm assuming you can't imprison a corporation.
Through the chair, I'll take a stab at that one if you'd like. You can imprison corporate officials, and that has happened in the past. And violations by corporations can be felonies. And I know the feds and states have actually imprisoned certain corporate officers for engaging in illegal antitrust conduct that's resulted in a conviction. You have to go up the chain. It's a little difficult to do, but you can put corporate officers in jail if they violate these laws and are convicted of these felonies.
Okay, thank you.
No follow-up?
No, that'll do it.
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any questions on my own bill.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, we're talking of, let me see if I got it right, $1 million and $50 million?
Through the chair, that's correct.
That's what's in the CS. I was just looking at the other state antitrust civil penalties. It doesn't appear that any of the others are anywhere near that amount.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Chenault, that is correct, other than the federal government, which is at $10 million and $100 million. But, no, that's correct. And I think a lot of these other state penalties were enacted, most of them back in either the 70s or the early 80s. So some of them are dated. But no, you are absolutely correct. We would be definitely on the high side of what's currently exists in other states.
Well, it concerns me that we're trying to be like the federal government. In the, just that aspect alone. Other than that, I really don't have any problem with the piece of legislation. Just I don't know if I really strive to be like the federal government or not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Any further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, you know, when I look at Kansas, for example, and they have up to $5,000 per day, how does that measure from the time that you understand there's an antitrust violation until it's resolved? I mean, because that could actually be quite a bit of money if it's, mm-hmm. you know, 4 or 5 years to resolve that kind of antitrust. So how would that work into where we would be? I mean, what's the determination of a per day? I mean, what's the start and what's the end of it?
Through the chair, Representative, that's an excellent question, and one of the reasons why we like to stay away from those kinds of penalty markers because it can be difficult to determine when that should start and when it should end. Typically, the violation penalty would start as soon as you have discovered that a violation has been committed, and either the entity agrees that's when it's been committed and you agree to some set penalty amount. If you end up going to court on that, it's, you know, whatever the jury or the judge decides was the start of the penalty, and it continues until the penalty was abated, which can also be the subject of a lot of discussion in these cases. You can argue that sometimes the violations, you know, stop when some fairly innocuous things happen. Maybe a memo is written by somebody to someone else in the company. It just creates, you know, a factual question that you'll have to deal with. If you just have a flat-out a penalty that is large enough, you avoid a lot of those things because it essentially becomes up to the court as to, you know, what a fair penalty would be considering the goal of deterrence and, you know, the size of the company and other things without having to go through that, you know, the other exercise of determining a daily amount.
Follow-up. Thank you. Would it not be a deterrent if the clock is running and the meter's going up on every day that they would want to settle quicker as opposed to looking at maybe a $50 million fine? Wouldn't they be more willing to settle before the number got that big or more likely to take a $50 million case to court?
Through the chair, there is certainly some logic in that. And if I was a company and I knew the fines were racking up on a daily basis, I think that might provide me, you know, some incentive to resolve these fairly quickly. But and I think it would depend on the company. If you're an Exxon or an Alaska Airlines or somebody, and you think, oh, it's $5,000 a day, that may just be the cost of doing business. When you know it could be, you know, a $50 million penalty if they don't stop it right away, that may provide, you know, just as much incentive. So. I understand your position, and I don't disagree with that at all. I think it can be a powerful incentive. I don't know that a $50 million potential penalty is any less of an incentive, though, either.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ed, are you familiar with Sempra versus the state of California?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say yes, but if I did, I'd get it wrong, so I'm going to say no.
It was price fixing during the, probably had to be 10 or 12 years ago, and I believe the state of California prevailed on behalf of, you know, like 200 political subdivisions. I want to say it was almost $2 billion that they settled out of court for, but I think the original amount of the damages alleged was $30 billion, $35 billion. So from that standpoint, if I'm right and it was $2 billion or even close to it, we're a little bit on the light side, or we could be on the light side.
Now we're trying to be like California?
Oh, no. Hey, they won. They won.
Oh,
just following the speaker's lead, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
No, that was for the speaker.
Did you want my comment, Mr.
Chairman? No, actually, I followed that one quite closely because we had something going on up here at the same time that was appeared to be might be going in the same direction.
To do with electrical costs. And
any further questions for Mr. Sniffen? Thanks again, Ed. Anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, do we have anybody online, Conrad? With that, I think we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, was there somebody here from Department of Law to talk about the fiscal note?
I think James
or lack thereof.
How about Ed? You still with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I did prepare the fiscal note on this one, and there should be no fiscal impact to the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Follow up?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ed, so you don't think we're going to use this law? If there's no
Mr. Chair, I think we will, but the kinds of cases that we would bring under this law are the kinds of cases we're already currently doing. What this would do is just allow us to actually recover more in penalties than under the current regime. So I don't know that this would generate more work for us. I think just with the work we currently do, we would get better recoveries.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, just as a comment, we see zero fiscal notes all the time, but it seems like each year the departments continue to ask for more money. And I think some of it has to do with the legislation that we pass, and so I just want to make other committee members aware that as we pass these, at some point in time, there is a cost for doing business.
I believe the next stop on this is finance, if it moves out of committee. Representative Campbell.
Campbell?
Campbell.
Long day.
New member of the committee.
New member of the committee. Ed, how many of these are you doing now?
Through the chair, Representative, currently we have two cases that we're that are under investigation that would be implicated by this legislation. Last year, we just resolved a multi-state case involving the drug Obcon, which is marketed by Warner Chilcott and Bar Pharmaceuticals. And I've got another case in the pipeline that I'm thinking about that would probably not be worth pursuing unless we had something like this that would give us some significant recovery. So there's a few, not tons. It's not like we have a dozen of these out there, but you know they do come up from time to time.
Maybe we should have a positive fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, I believe the next stop is judiciary. I stand corrected. But I'm sure if
like to entertain a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no objection, I'll make the motion to move CS for House Bill Number 87, which is 27-LS033I/I, Bannister, 216 of 11, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves on to judiciary. And we'll take a brief at ease. The agenda today is House Bill 164, Insurance, Health Care, and Other. With us, we have Division of Insurance. Welcome back, Linda.
Do this now.
Linda Hall, Director.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, before we get started, I'd like to move the CS for HB 164, which is designated 26-LSO444M, as a working document, so we can all be on the same page.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay.
Welcome back, Ms. Hall. Seems like you've been here almost every day this session.
You missed us.
Thank you, I think, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. The CS you have before you today has a number of changes, most of them fairly minor. so I won't go through all 63 pages. It is shorter now. Most of these
How many pages did you save us?
How many changes?
How many pages?
Oh, well, seven.
Seven?
It went from 70 to 63, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
The majority of changes were to clarify. There were items of consistency with other sections. It is a lengthy bill that I've already apologized to you the first time I testified. They were picked up by the drafter, and we agreed with those changes. I'm not, unless you'd really like me to, going to go through each of those. They were kind of wordsmithing. I would start with page 50. See how fast we can go. We have added a piece of language at the beginning of this section to clarify and make sure that the concerns this committee had over this particular provision were addressed. On line 9, the beginning of that, notwithstanding the definition of group market in AS 2154-500, we wanted to make sure that there was no ambiguity in whether or not you could still have individual policies sold to a group under certain circumstances. And so we added that in for, I would say, extra clarity. So that is one change. The second major change is Section 93 of the bill, which is on page 62. We have added, this is a provision that was not in the bill previously. We have added the ability on line 8 on page 62, unless another form of payment is agreed to by the policyholder or beneficiary, to the language that's currently here that an insurer must pay with a negotiable bank check. You may have read last year there were some publicity about the use by life insurance companies of things called checkbooks, and these were a way of distributing proceeds from life insurance. We think they are an acceptable way to distribute proceeds because it allows the beneficiary to have time to determine what to do with the funds, but the policyholder or the beneficiary would have to agree to something other than a negotiable check. That we would like to add this particular provision to our statute. We would be adopting regulations that would require various types of disclosures. There is a model that has disclosures and sign-off on this, but it is, I think, a provision that would allow life insurance companies and beneficiaries of those policies to have some say in how they receive the funds rather than receiving a large lump sum at a time of emotional distress. They would be able to have the money. It's still accessible, but it's just not given to them in a lump sum unless they so request that. So that would be one addition to the bill. The section that we've deleted that made the bill shorter, we deleted sections 86 and 87. They dealt with insolvencies and loss reimbursement handling, money going to the guarantee fund. There is concern in the industry about various provisions and how that would impact Alaska versus other states. And we have requested of the sponsor that those sections be deleted from this bill. The last change that's really reflected in the CS of substance deals with Section 62 and 77, the individual and group rate filings. I talked to you at some length about having the ability to review health insurance rates prior to their being used. We have adjusted this language so that it matches the file and use language of our other insurance rates. Rates still must be filed with us before they're used. We have the opportunity to review them. They would go into effect 45 days after filing if they're not disapproved. And we've also added an effective date of this particular provision of January 1 of 2012 to allow insurers time to adopt those changes and be ready to do those filings with us. And that, Mr. Chairman, really is a brief summary of the changes in the CS. I would be happy to answer questions.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda, back to the checkbook issue. That provision would only be in place if the beneficiary of the life insurance policy knew that they were the beneficiary of the life insurance policy. They would be the ones that have to agree to a checkbook type system versus a one-time payout, right?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, either the policyholder, the person who had the life insurance, or the beneficiary, one or the other would have to agree to that. The policyholder could designate that up front. The beneficiary would only probably exercise that option if they knew.
The beneficiary could also, if I may, Mr. Chairman, then the beneficiary could also elect to take it in lump sum. Versus
through the chair, yes. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No further questions, apparently. Do you want to stay at the table, though, please, in case we need you?
Certainly.
We can cut down on the transit time. With that, again, we'll open it up to the public. Oh, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection? In that case, we will adopt.
Move the amendment.
Pardon me?
We have adopted the CS. Mr. Chairman, at this time, I'd also move conceptual amendment to the CS for 164, which is designated 27LSO444/M.
I'll object for discussion.
And that is in your packet.
Ms. Hall, can you walk us through the nine lines?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The nine lines are basically additional pieces of language that, as we've really worked with these 70 pages, and we've worked with them since July, that we found some inconsistencies. The first two deal with the title. The provision we just spoke about, the retained asset accounts, Section 93, we've added the reference to that in the title. The next two, 4 and 5, are just language cleanups that we didn't get the first time. The page 38 and 49 are the two rate filings we have made consistent the language at 45 days instead of 30 days, and we have changed language the drafter had done to have rates become effective to may become effective so that an insurance company can make their rates effective farther out than 45 days. They won't automatically become effective in 45 days. They would have the opportunity to make that farther into the future should they so choose.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may sound like a silly question, but do rates ever go down where we would want them to be at 45 days and not give them an opportunity to extend?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the health insurance rates have not. Some rates do. But we do see rate decreases in some areas. This is not normally one of them.
Follow?
And this, Mr. Chairman, this specifically deals with help. Okay. If they've got an option and you approve it and it's going to be less, why not do it now? That's my only concern, but it doesn't seem to be going down.
Any more questions?
I'll remove my objection.
Any further objections? The conceptual amendment, well, I guess it's not a conceptual, 27LS0444/M is accepted. And that brings us to public testimony. Oh, Ms. Hall.
There was one more piece of information that I was going to address very briefly, a letter that was received by the committee. If there's a question, I guess I would say if there's a question about the letter or if you would like me to address some of the issues in that letter, I would be happy to.
What are the wishes of the committee? It's in the packet as
the National Association of Professional Lines.
Pardon me? Yeah. That'd be it.
You want me to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe all of you received last week a letter dated March 4th, 2011, from NAPSLO regarding the surplus lines piece of this bill. And I would like to just make a few brief comments, then I would entertain any questions. There were several statements in the letter. Some I agree with, some I don't. But one I would agree with starting out, that we are not required to share the taxes. We are changing the way in which we collect taxes on surplus lines coverage, and it is accurate that we're not required to share that. But most of the premise of the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Act was that the states will regulate their own risk, collect the taxes, and then allocate those to the states where the risk is located. There are statements about taxing authority being given to an agency. I would respond to that is that this legislature has already given taxing authority to the Division of Insurance. We today levy taxes on all insurance premiums, so that is not a new authority being given to an agency. I would also comment that this is not a quote-unquote policymaking power, but it's authority to participate in a clearinghouse. The legislation specifically states that the agreements are solely to the allow for the mutual allocation of premium taxes. So it's collection and allocation. It's more a ministerial function as opposed to any type of policy agreement. I also would respond that this is not a tax increase. Our policyholders today are taxed at the premium tax rates of each of the states where they may have some type of risk located. We aren't changing the way we tax. In fact, our surplus lines taxes are lower than most states, so we're not increasing taxes on these policyholders. We're just changing the way it's collected and who collects it and how it's allocated back out. Today, taxes paid at the state rates in every state where there's a portion of the risk. This is an attempt, the federal legislation was an attempt to streamline that process. We are trying to, in this statute, these sections, make our statutes conform to the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Act that is effective July 21st of 2011. So that we are not in violation of federal law, which specifically preempts the state statutes. And I won't go beyond that unless somebody really has questions. I have one more. Sorry.
Please continue.
I'm sorry. I do apologize, Mr. Chairman. I do want to tell you that this is not something that the Division of Insurance dreamed up all by itself. This particular type of legislation to authorize entry into this type of, it's called NEMA, or an interstate agreement, is pending in 17 states. There is another compact-type legislation, which is much more complicated, which is pending in 8 states. There is competing legislation on these two types of things in 5 states. So 5 states have 2 totally different ways of dealing with this law pending before them. Some states are 11 states that haven't done anything but study the issue. So there's lots of different types of ways that federal law is being looked at by legislatures. And I would be happy to answer any other questions you might have on this.
So, again, the bill as amended does bring us into conformance with
the bill as amendment.
NRRA.
The bill as amended does bring us into conformance with NRRA.
Any questions for Ms. Hall? Oh. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the letter, the next to the last paragraph,
NAPSLO respectfully requests that should Alaska wish to determine as a matter of public policy to share taxes. Who makes that determination? Is that something the department will do? Is that something the legislature has to do? Or we're not in that situation now, and if the compacts pass, that has to go through the legislature for compacts. So they're asking for clarity, and so that the brokers would, you know, clearly understand what's going on. Is there a system in place now that if that happens, that the brokers and everyone would clearly understand what's happening?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, this piece of legislation as proposed clearly says we will allocate to the states where the risk is located unless they have not entered into a mutual agreement. If the other state has not entered into a mutual agreement, we'll keep the tax. I think it's fairly clear in the proposal that was attached to this letter to change the statute. The language in the bill that talks about allocation and allocation formulas was deleted. I'm not sure what anybody thought we were going to do with that when you can't allocate at all. But I think this piece of legislation does say that we will share the taxes back to the states where the risk is located in the same way that they're paid directly to those states today. We're not giving up something that we don't get it today. But the federal law makes us collect all the tax, 100% of the tax, which is part of this language. So we're collecting today only the portion of the risk that is in Alaska. We only tax that part. Under the federal law, we now have to tax 100% of the policy for someone whose home state is Alaska. That's actually not going to be probably a whole lot of multi-state risks. But we collect 100%, and we would then allocate back, much as today that's paid in the individual state. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is the request is so that policyholders and brokers can clearly understand and review the code. Are you comfortable that that's available to a policyholder or a broker, that they can clearly understand what's going on with this legislation or through regulation or information? Or
through the chair, I am very comfortable that it's very clear in this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I got.
I can add that the NRRA has been in every insurance trade publication for the last few months since it was brought forth. And as Ms. Hall said, it's being looked at in a number of different ways. And the vehicle that appears to have the most support amongst the states is the version we're going, or the manner in which we're addressing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but that is not on my nighttime reading, so I appreciate you bringing me up to speed.
Not on your nightstand.
Not on my nightstand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking for the fiscal note on this thing.
Let's step and do that one, too.
I can see that. I would think that this would probably be a positive fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. And Linda, maybe you could enlighten me. Do you know how much money that we currently collect that we send to other states that isn't rightfully ours based upon this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, we don't collect for other states today. We only collect what's ours.
Mm-hmm.
So we aren't collecting something that we would send to anybody else.
Well,
they get their own.
I thought that earlier you said that we would be required to collect 100%.
Under the new version, we would collect 100% and allocate
theirs back
to them.
Okay, so then maybe there does need to be a fiscal note here. It's not gonna require any more time to make those allocations?
Through the chair, we don't make the allocation. The broker makes the allocation, or the clearinghouse that we're proposing would probably be tasked with making that allocation.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
And again, it would only apply to locations outside the state of Alaska, which I don't know what that is on a percentage basis, but can you take a hazard to guess?
We collect approximately, Mr. Chairman, $50 million in premium tax. About $3 million of that is surplus lines premium tax. Our estimate, and it's really an estimate, we don't collect statistics, so it's the best feel for the people in my staff who deal with this type of insurance and my tax auditor. And the estimate is maybe 500,000 of that is actually dealing with multi-state risks. So 500,000 of 50 million. It's a pretty nominal amount.
Follow up?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Ms. Hall? Does Ms. Hall have anything else to add?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm finished this time.
With that, we'll again go to the people in the room. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll go off-site. Is there anybody, any place in the state that would...
or outside the state.
I might add this is the third or fourth time that we've had public testimony with minimal impact. I think it's probably because Ms. Hall does such a good job of putting a bill forward. There's nobody online. Public testimony is closed on 164. Back to the committee. Committee comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chenault.
The loggers love this insurance industry.
Loggers have their own insurance company. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the CS for HB 164 as amended out of the committee with no physical notes.
Zero.
And individual. Zero physical notes?
Zero.
Zero physical notes. And individual recommendations.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee, and we will take a brief at ease. The last item on the agenda today is House Bill 155. The bill has been heard several times. We've taken a fair amount of public testimony. I think most of what we do today will be public testimony. The bill is not moving out today. We have a CS, that, or a, I'm sorry, an amendment that has been out for a week or so, and I'd entertain a motion to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move amendment number one, which is 27LS0249/B.3/Bannister 22111.
I'll object for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, for clarification, was that 22-11 or 221-11?
I'm sorry, 222-11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, I'm going to bring up Jennifer Sinnott, committee aide to the Labor and Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of committee. For the record, Jennifer Sinnott, staff to the chair. The amendment you have before you, as Mr. Chairman said, it has been in front of you guys, I believe, for about a week. So it shouldn't really come as a surprise. It's a short amendment, as you'll see, and it does two things. You'll notice the first change we have is on page 1, line 5, and this would drop the threshold down to $50,000. You'll remember that the original bill was, the threshold was set at $75,000. The second change in this amendment is in Section 8 of the bill. If you'll turn to page 4, it's lines 8 and 9. Here we are deleting, except for a school district of a municipality or a regional educational attendance area. As we mentioned during the first hearing on the bill, we had a miscommunication during drafting of the bill that exempted school districts from the requirements of this legislation. That wasn't our original intent, and so this amendment corrects that, and it brings school districts back under the umbrella to where they are now subject to the same $50,000 cap that other public projects would be. So that's the amendment.
Any further objection?
I'll remove my objection.
Is there any objection to the amendment? Any other objection? Seeing none, amendment, is that one or two? One.
I believe it's number one.
Passes. I might add that we are still working our way through the definition of maintenance. It was not included in this, and I think everybody's known that since they've had the amendment for a period of time. But at this point in time, we're going to open up, reopen public testimony or continue public testimony. And looks like we've got a lot of people signed up, and I'm going to try to limit everybody to 3 minutes. I'm just guessing that we probably have at least 30 people signed up, including people in the room. And I guess we'll start in the room. How about Max Melke? Please join us. State your name and affiliation for the record.
Representative, Mr. Chair. My name is Max Melke. I am the about 56-year resident of Juneau, Alaska here, and been a plumber pipe fitter for 35 years of my life, and I'm also the business manager for the plumbers and pipe fitters here in southeast Alaska, and we have about we got about 100 members here throughout southeast Alaska and 11 signatory contractors, and I just want to say I strongly oppose House Bill 155. And one of the problems I see with it is back in the 80s, early 90s, when the pipeline kind of, you know, the works slowed way down up there, and Prudhoe Bay kind of wound down and all that stuff. We've had some pretty tough times back in the 80s and early 90s, and I remember when I was working out in the field, you know, there was times where I might be laid off for 2 or 3 months out of the year, and you know, things were pretty tough, and it wasn't for these little small projects that our contractors bid on. I mean, it really kept us going, you know what I'm saying? So putting a threshold and raising that limit up there, I think that's just bad bad for business. It kind of put us out of business. And I just want to say, too, it's not, you know, it's not a non-union issue here. It's about the construction worker and his family and you know, what that does to them by putting less money on their table, you know what I'm saying? So and I'm glad to see that there was an amendment brought up here a few minutes ago about taking the school districts back and putting it back in down there. That's a good portion of what I was going to testify on today. And I just kind of think that this is kind of a form of right-to-work legislation, and I think it's a start to the race to the bottom. And that's really all I have to say. And if you guys have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them for you.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us.
One question.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, sir. Just in the when I look at this bill, I see basically three things going on. Mm-hmm. One of them was corrected, I believe, with the amendment. We're still trying to figure out what, excuse me, Maintenance Works does. Would there be any number in the beginning of this, excuse me, that currently I understand that Davis-Bacon wages would kick in at a $2,000 minimum right now. Is there any number that you and your organization would feel comfortable with?
You know, right now we got a couple of carpenters working out at our union hall right now, and you know, these are the kind of jobs I'm really talking about. And you know, they're probably going to be there for a couple of weeks doing a small project, and it's probably going to come under about $12,000. So that's, you know, I mean, those kind of projects, I remember when I was coming up through my apprenticeship, or not my apprenticeship, because I worked up in Prudhoe Bay a lot, but stuff like that. But, you know, coming up through my career, those small projects are what kind of kept us going in the lean times, and I really, I'm kind of worried about that for our members especially, you know, and it's just, you know, you put less money in the construction worker's pocket, that's less money in the economy. It's not good for anybody. So,
if I could comment for the people that weren't in the room for previous testimony, the $2,000 was set in 1935 and hasn't been adjusted since then. And purely on an inflation basis, I believe it would be 37.32. I stand corrected. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just don't think the construction markets have changed all that much. I mean, it's just, you know, I suppose little jobs cost more. But, you know, we're still looking at those small little projects that really do keep us busy. So, and they're our bread and butter for our contractors and the workers also. So, you know, I just hate to see anything happen to that, but that's all I have.
Thanks again.
Okay, you bet. Thank you very much.
Matt Melke. Matthew. Any relation?
Unfortunately, yes. if I could actually put it on the record, I'll go my mother's maiden name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Please state one of your names for the record.
Matthew Melke. I'm here representing myself, and I was born and raised in this town. And, I mean, I grew up, you know, Dad worked construction my whole life, and I've worked in the trades as long as I've been able to. And, you know, I mean, the same as he said, there are a lot of small jobs that have really made a difference for me. You know, I don't know how many times I wouldn't have been able to put food on my own table if it wasn't for, you know, a $5,000 job that my boss got. And, you know, I don't know that there's any limit to how low of a number you could go before it starts doing damage to, you know, to people like me, where I'm going to be sitting at home drawing unemployment, doing nothing to contribute for anybody because someone from, you know, out of state was able to get the upper hand on a job, whereas, you know, maybe they're not going to do a good job. Doesn't really matter to them. They're going to, you know, come in and low bid something because they can do it for cheap, do subpar work and leave, and they don't really care if they get a bad reputation for it. Whereas, you know, if you have, you know, I mean, laws like this allow people who live in this town and live in the same communities that you represent to do good work and maintain their reputations and to be proud of the job that they hold in that town. And it's, I mean, it's very important to me. You know, I look around the room and I don't really fit in here. But I think that's, I mean, the biggest reason
everybody
for me to
fits
be
into
here.
This room and the rest of the committee rooms in the building and the galleries.
And it's, I mean, that's, I guess that's all I have to say.
And I might add, we've got at least one person at the table whose family has employed any number of people, both union and non-union, I think. Representative Chenault, both shops?
Over time, that's
over
correct.
Over time, yeah. I've also been out to his yard and see him filling sandbags as recently as last summer.
Don't completely ruin my reputation.
Mr. Melke, I just ruined his reputation, I know. Show him your hands, Mike.
They're pretty soft right now.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
John Smith. And you're no relation to the Melkies, are you?
Well, name Mike Smith, who knows? My name is Jonathan Smith. I work for the Alaska Regional Council of Carpenters. I grew up in Gillingham, Southwest Alaska. I currently live in Juneau for the last 11 years. You know, this is, I'm here to speak in opposition of this bill, House Bill 155. I think it's misleading. A lot of people think, you know, more bang for the buck, those types of things. Stretch a dollar, make it easier for people in Alaska to bid on these projects. I stumbled across a couple of quotes I'd like to just present for you. You know, the proponents of prevailing wage legislation wanted to prevent government from using its purchasing power to undermine wages of its citizens. It is believed that government should be set an example by paying the wages prevailing in the locality for each occupant hired to do government contracts and building public projects. That was the first one. You know, and to me that kind of rings true. I mean, we're setting an example by creating the prevailing wage, the area standard. You know, it's not cheap to live in Alaska. It's expensive. Especially in rural Alaska. I mean, if you start cutting the wages because the prevailing dollars go out there, you know, I grew up working construction area from $10, $15 to prevailing wage. You always like them Davis Bacon jobs coming because you knew what you were going to get paid. So it was definitely important for me growing up working construction, fishing, at least on the construction point, knowing the prevailing wage. And one more here. You know, the purpose of the Davis Bacon Act is to protect its employees, government, contractors from substandard wages and promote the hiring of local labor rather than the cheap labor from distant places. You know, we start lowering, getting rid of Davis Bacon. That's a level playing field. When contractors come to Alaska and they're building a Title 36 project, they know it's going to cost this much labor. Whether it's union or not, it's going to cost this much. You take that away from the people who work here, now that same contractor comes in realizing that he no longer has to pay that wage to those people. He can pay whatever and bring his crew in because most Alaskans can't afford to work for less. on a big project, you know. But people from lower 48, where the standard of living is cheaper, the wages are less. We'll work for the wages because, quite frankly, they're what they're getting paid at home. So, especially with the economy the way it is down there. And I guess in closing, one more, I guess, quick example, I guess, is since the value has changed to $50,000, you know, the cost today of a project, $50,000 project, is, well, $50,000. But we know that Department of Labor is going to get a fee for the certified payroll, and that the wage for the people working on the project is set. Now, if this legislation passes, that same project, $50,000, is going to cost $50,000, but now the Department of Labor gets no resources, no certified payroll, and who knows what the employees get paid. The contractor still bills out at $50,000, but the wages going to the people working the project could be anywhere from 10 to 5, well, minimum wage to prevailing wage. So that's about all I have. So, thank you.
Thanks again, Mr. Smith. We're going to go off offline now to Marvin Yoder. Are you with us, Marvin?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Marvin Yoder, M-A-R-V-I-N-Y-O-D-E-R, and I'm with the city of Wasilla, although I also had worked in Bush, Alaska quite a bit. And I'm speaking in favor of this bill. There's been a lot of discussion. I heard the testimony last week and a lot of discussion about the impact to the communities. First of all, and percentage-wise, we're talking a pretty small amount. If you look at the fact that private companies aren't under this anyway, this is mostly state and local government stuff, and I had been for the last several weeks going through the governor's budget looking at things for our community. And one of the things I noticed is there's very few projects in there under $100,000. And so we're not talking about an awful lot of business here. There's a very low percentage that this is actually going to affect. And it may be true that for $50,000 an out-of-state contractor would come to Anchorage or Fairbanks and mobilize for that. I don't think it's likely they would do it to Fort Yukon for $50,000 from Seattle. And I worked most of my time in Bush, Alaska, had a lot of small projects that the cities were trying to run. And it's not just the wages that the cities are worried about out there. Some of it is the paperwork and the bookwork that goes with it. You've got short staff in the office as well as in the field. And I think that in Bush, Alaska, it's good for these communities with their real tight budgets and not a lot of staff to be able to take these small projects. We're not talking about a big change. It is big from 2,000 to 50,000, but as you pointed out, that's for 70 years worth of inflation. And so I feel like, and we feel like, that for those small projects, it makes it much easier for the municipalities or the state in these small projects to be able to have this kind of a threshold and be more efficient.
Any questions for Mr. Yoder? Thanks again, Marvin. Shane Lenz.
Hello, my name is Shane Lindsay, representing myself. I am a resident of Wasilla. I do have some concerns about House Bill 155. If it's not broke, why fix it? The state has done well with its finances and has about $12 billion surplus. With that being said, this really wouldn't benefit the state a great deal. But what it would do is allow lower wages to be paid and in turn lower the quality of work that is to be done. As the saying goes, you get what you pay for, and this Davis-Bacon allows an even playing field for all the contractors when they're bidding on these contracts. Therefore, I oppose House Bill 155. Thank you. Any questions?
Thanks again, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you.
Lori Davey.
Hello, this is Lori.
Oh, hi. Could you please state your name and affiliation, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi there. My name is Lori Davey, and I'm representing the South Golden View Rural Road Service Area.
And what?
Do you want me to go on?
What community?
Anchorage.
Oh, okay. Please continue.
Okay. We're a volunteer road board with 17 and a half miles off the Rabbit Creek and Golden View area in the Anchorage Hillside, and we're here to support House Bill 155. My fellow board member, Robert Johnson, is here with me today, and we've been grappling with the requirements of any time $2,000 or more is spent on a project, the Davis-Bacon wages always kick in. $2,000 of materials is a very low threshold when dealing with road improvements. A culvert replacement or pothole material can easily go over $2,000 and trigger the Davis-Bacon rates. Because of this, it significantly inflates the cost of our road work. Considering that the rate has been in place with no change since 1935, even the basic rate of inflation at 3% per year would bring the rate up to at least $32,000 by 2010, with an average inflation rate of 3.78. And Davis-Bacon wages are way beyond a prevailing wage. We pay almost double when we have to pay the Davis-Bacon wages, and we're not able to fix as many roads, and this money comes directly out of property tax dollars. And our area of people pay 1.8 mils for $100,000 valuation in their homes. So this isn't necessarily about big companies. These are Anchorage taxpayers. By increasing the threshold to $50,000 and more clearly defining the difference between maintenance and construction, we'll be able to maintain and improve our roads more cost-effectively. The basic buying power with inflation corrections for public construction will double, and more roads will be able to be improved. We hope you'll pass this legislation so that our public money can be better utilized more efficiently and more work can be accomplished on our roads. Thank you.
Thanks again, Lori. Nancy Peterson, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nancy Peterson, and I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Unalaska. I would like to testify today in support of House Bill 155. As a manager that's responsible for the construction of rural public projects, I'm very supportive of raising the dollar threshold for the application of the Lowell Davis-Bacon Act. I've seen many small projects grow too much in cost to remain viable and therefore never get built due to the wage requirements. I've also worked with small contractors who chose not to bid on projects because of the added reporting requirements on these small projects. I'd also like to share that I've served on the Alaska Municipal League Public Works and Infrastructure Legislative Subcommittee for the last 8 years. And during each of those years, I've listened to the elected officials from small communities and villages tell about the projects that they've lost due to the extra cost of the wage requirements. These communities have very limited resources, and when you take a $15,000 project that grows into a $20,000 project, it often means the difference in building it or not building it. Many of these projects are projects that you might call quality of life projects versus projects that are driven by life safety issues. These are the projects that are good to have, but they can't necessarily be justified when the costs escalate. I listened to the testimony on the 28th, and I heard one speaker mention the small number of projects that this bill would affect based on the number of projects under $75,000 that the state had in their database. I would ask you to consider all those projects that are not in the database and did not get built because the costs grew too much and the communities were no longer able to support them. So, I think House Bill 155 would create new opportunities for all of Alaska's communities, and I strongly urge its passage.
Any questions for Ms. Peterson? Thanks again for joining us today. Shirley Marquardt.
Yes, thank you.
Shirley Marquardt, are you with us, Shirley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I'm Shirley Marquardt. I'm the mayor of the City of Unalaska, and I'm also currently the first vice president of the Alaska Municipal League. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to publicly support the passage of House Bill 155, which AML is on record supporting with our resolution 2011-18 with a $50,000 threshold. Our united recommendation at our last annual membership meeting is that the threshold on Little Davis-Bacon wages be raised from $2,000 to $50,000 on public construction contracts and an exclusion for maintenance contracts be added. We truly believe this is a reasonable and responsible adjustment after 76 years of the status quo for the wage threshold, while construction and maintenance costs have maintained a steady increase. With the long overdue adjustment and the exclusion of maintenance contracts, the legislature will be providing opportunities to municipalities that currently forgo projects or maintenance because of the cost. This is a significantly positive change for communities large and small all over rural Alaska. We feel that jobs and upgraded infrastructure, as smaller projects become a reality, provide a win-win with the passage of HB 155. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you again, Shirley.
Welcome.
Brett Helms. Fairbanks.
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Brett Helms, and I'm a member of Local 375 in Fairbanks. I am the training director for Local 375, and I'm against the proposed modifications to Davis-Bacon and House Bill 155. The proposal to raise the threshold limit will not necessarily lower construction costs, but in fact may increase the number of out-of-state employers bidding on state-funded projects. Currently, employers are required to pay Davis-Bacon journeyman prevailing wages to employees unless the employer has a federally registered apprenticeship program. The exemptions of House Bill 155 are passed. Employers will not be required to have a registered apprenticeship program, and wages will be subjective to the employer. I'm concerned that the apprentices trained through our program will not have the opportunity to work on these projects. These are good jobs, jobs that allow these Alaskan men and women to support their communities, raise families, and remain in Alaska. Instead, they may be replaced by a cheap, non-resident, lower-skilled workforce brought up from out-of-state. In conclusion, the proposal will diminish wages and lower the standard of living in communities across Alaska, communities that are already suffering in the depressed economy. Thank you for hearing my comments.
Thanks again. Zeb Woodman.
Hi, my name is Zeb Woodman. I'm with the Labor's Local 942. I've lived in Alaska all my life, and I would ask you to leave this law alone. By exempting Davis-Bacon from jobs up to $50,000, you would have affected hundreds of projects last year. With many of the projects this size being awarded to non-union contractors, this proposal attacks wages for many non-union workers who do not have a voice advocating for them. With the pay set for workers gives a level playing field to all bidding contractors, ensuring a quality wage, not a race to the bottom by contractors who are willing to pay workers less. This bill aims to take dollars away from the worker so the municipality could get more work for less money. No one suggested taking a dime from a contractor or limiting rental rates on equipment or limit the profit on the sale of material. There was also a lot of talk of how paperwork for the Department of Labor was too much for the contractor to do. So if we take money out of the worker's pocket, it'll make life better for the contractor. What about the life of the working families? Raising the threshold will not necessarily reduce the cost of the bids. Rather, contractors will pocket more money while workers are paid less. I urge you to oppose House Bill 155.
Thanks again for joining us, Mr. Woodman. Gene Traynor, are you with us, Gene?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gene Traynor. I'm from Fairbanks. I've lived in Alaska for 35 years, and I urge you to oppose House Bill 155. Bear with me. I'm a little nervous, and I don't have notes in front of me. This is like the guy before me was saying, it's a race to the bottom. I have seen and heard over and over and over stories about low-paid workers coming up from the lower 48, coming in here, and the bottom line is you're taking Alaskan dollars and spending them outside. Is it helping communities here? No, it isn't. If you want to support Alaskan families, Alaskan communities, You pay living wages, fair wages, and you spend them right here in the communities. And that's the way to have strong communities here, not, you know, low-paid workers coming up from outside. It really bothers me when I see that driving down of the wages. I don't buy that it's going to make projects stop. I think that when you look at those, how many projects last year alone were in that threshold between two and fifty thousand? Just like 1,400 projects or something. I don't know. My notes aren't in front of me. Sorry, but that's the bread and butter issue thing, where there's small projects. It keeps people going between the big building projects. And when you see the way the boom and bust economy moves in Alaska, there are those times when the fair wages that you pay with Davis Bacon see those families through when the projects are slim and, you know, few and far between. Anyway, thanks for hearing me out. That's all I have to say.
Will you take a question? Or represent?
Oh, sure.
No. Yes,
I'll take a question.
Yes. Let's try that over again. Representative Thompson. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Traynor, who do you represent?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm representing Alaska Public Employees Association, okay. But I'm also representing myself as a long-time non-union worker and a union worker.
Follow-up question then?
Certainly.
You live outside of town in Fairbanks?
I live in the Goldstream Valley.
You live on a road service district area?
Yes, and I still support getting rid of this House Bill 155.
But this, Little Davis Bacon has a potential to double or even higher on your road service cost added to your property tax.
And I am fully supportive of seeing the people who grade my road getting a fair wage. That's all there is to it.
Okay, thank you.
Equal time?
No, I think it covered it pretty well.
Thanks again, Ms. Traynor. Jim, I think I'm going to butcher the name. Lighty.
Hi. Chairman Olson and members of House Labor and Commerce, thank you for this opportunity today. My name is Jim Lighty. I'm a member of Local 375 and also represent the local as a business representative. I was born and raised in Alaska, lived here my entire life, and I'm fortunate enough to have worked around the construction industry since the 1970s. You know, the local contractors that I worked for many times, you know, the work here is seasonal and cyclical. You know, economically, we've all seen that. Anybody that's been around Alaska understands that. And I can think of many years when local contractors that I worked for, you know, I might have worked for six or eight local contractors, and additionally, you know, some of the projects that I was sent out on might be, you know, a day job or a week job or a month job, whatever it is, but that helped to support those local contractors, you know, who in the off season have to maintain their facilities, their staff, they've got overhead, as well as, you know, the other workers, my family, friends that worked at the industry that maintained their homes here, you know, in the winter months when others who might come in and capitalize just on the short construction season, you know, don't have to support, you know, a home or a family here. And so I would just like to say, you know, with my experience in the construction season and I would urge you not to advance House Bill 155, which is going to negatively impact Alaska workers as well as contractors. And many times, you know, the construction projects, you know, it might be a renovation or a maintenance project that is just a short-term project, but you still, from my perspective with the pipe trades, you've if you don't, as others have said, you get what you pay for. And a lot of times, a skilled, highly trained worker makes all the difference in how a project ends up, you know, a day later or a year later or whatever. And sometimes the savings, you know, isn't reflected, you know, in the initial cost. So thank you for your consideration, and I appreciate the chance to speak on this today. Thank you.
Oh, thanks again, Jim. Jason Allward. Jason Allward?
Sorry, had some problems with the mic. Too close, too.
Oh. Well, thanks for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Jason Allward. I'm a business agent with Local 302 and a lifelong Alaskan. I'm speaking on behalf of myself today. The question today before me, anyhow, is whether we feel we have a problem with the current although very old statute that lists the public construction contracts over $2,000 should be covered under prevailing wages. The answer to me on this issue is no, we don't have a problem with status quo. Keep in mind that we do have 7 or 8 states that have lower thresholds or no threshold at all. So the way the state is currently doing business assures that Alaskan hire is a priority. Workforce development is a big issue in this, and it provides a level playing field for contractors by eliminating the ability to get jobs on the backs of their employees. Raising the threshold does not necessarily mean that jobs will cost the state any less. It only guarantees that workers will be paid less, and even worse is the fact it may not even be an Alaskan worker. Once again, I think somebody else mentioned it, race to the bottom approach is not what is needed right now with coffers in excess of $12 billion. Diminished wages for Alaskans who depend on these mostly seasonal occupations is simply not the answer. So, in conclusion, I oppose House Bill 155. Thank you. Today.
Thanks again for joining us. Ron Axtell. Ron Axtell.
There you go. Yes, good afternoon. I want to thank the committee for hearing me today. My name is Ron Axtell. I help represent over 2,000 Alaska labor union members in South Central Alaska. I talk here not just for the members of the labor's union, but also the small business workers. Should they not be entitled to a living wage? Most, if not all, small business workers enjoy making Davis-Bacon wages, as not all contractors secure work in this sector. We talk about strengthening our workforce and improving the economics of our great state. How are we to do this when this bill has the potential to move us backwards? When you take and raise this threshold, you will be lowering the standards of many workers who count on prevailing wage work. Where is the incentive for learning? If the wage is not adequate, not to say that jobs will even be available. A higher ceiling will make it more likely that our outside companies will bid, and if successful, work will be awarded to them. There is no guarantee that they will even hire local workers to do the work upon receiving that bid. The state subsidizes a whole arena of programs. Is it true to say, with less pay, more subsidizing these programs? What I'd like you to consider is this. Is this action the right thing to do? I would like for you to make no changes to the current limit. Thank you for hearing me today.
Thanks again for joining us. Harry Loeffler, are you with us, Harry? Harry Loeffler? Keith Montgomery.
Montgomery. I'm a 28-year resident of the state of Alaska and a member of Carpers Local 1281. I'm a business representative of that local union. I want to go on record as upholding House Bill 155, lowering the threshold. There's other parts of the bill, Section 8, the maintenance and also the political subdivisions I'm glad to see that we did put back in the schools, but, you know, the other portions where, you know, eliminates municipalities and boroughs is a concern. A lot has been said on this bill, and I believe that it does not provide a mechanism to, you know, to develop workforce development and also the area standards that are set forth by prevailing wage jobs. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us. John Garrett.
Yes. Hi, my name is John Garrett, and I represent Sheet Metal Workers Local 23, and I've been a resident of Alaska here for the past 18 years. I'm opposed to House Bill 155. You know, I've heard a lot of the testimony here today, and I understand that there's been testimony previously. You know, I think one of the things that may be overlooked is if you start raising thresholds on this type of construction work, jobs could be divided up into phases. And you see that on when you go into the plans room or any of the other sites where jobs are bid, you'll see them under phases. And so you could potentially have a job that has a valuation of even as much as $500,000, $1 million, divided up into 10 or more phases, and all of it legal under a proposed raise threshold being raised. And it's just another way to game the system, to go to this, what we've talked about today, the race to the bottom, where it makes it where people can't afford to even live in this state. And every person that's lived here in the last several years has seen their health care go up exponentially. They've watched the cost of their utility bills go up exponentially. And these are the types of things that every family depends upon. This isn't a union or a non-union issue. This is a worker issue. And I don't understand why we need to put the burden on the workers, and, you know, especially in an environment where we're not, you know, economically challenged. Certainly costs need to be looked at and managed, but this isn't the way to do it, attacking workers. Thank you for your time.
Thanks again for joining us. Bronson Fry, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thanks again for participating.
Hello there. My name is Bronson Fry. I'm with the Painters and Allied Trades Union, Local 1959.
Please.
I would like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee. I wanted to let you know that I'm a lifelong Alaskan, a journeyman drywall finisher and painter by trade. I've worked both union and non-union in my career, and I currently work representing painters, drywall finishers, floor covers, and glazers or glass workers. I've been involved in the commercial construction industry in Alaska for 10 years now, and I'm here today because I firmly feel that Davis-Bacon or prevailing wage jobs provide the financial lifeblood for many construction workers in Alaska. I base this opinion on both my personal experience in the field and from what I've seen and heard from hundreds of other construction workers in Alaska through the years. And I wish to emphasize that this is not a union versus non-union issue, because the wages paid to both the non-union and union workers on Davis-Bacon projects promotes the growth of the middle class and helps boost our state's overall economy. Additionally, with the $12 billion state surplus, I think it would be a travesty to pass a bill that would devastate the income of thousands of construction workers in Alaska. Further, I'd like to take a moment and explain to you what race to the bottom means. We've heard that phrase several times today, and it has a very real and tangible meaning. The reason that I feel that way is because in construction, when a contractor goes to bid a job, there are three main variables that he must calculate and account for. The first is his material cost, the lumber, the paint, etc., which is approximately the same for all the contractors in the industry. The second is your company's overhead, cost of keeping an office open, estimating work, etc., which is also about the same for everyone in the industry, depending on the size of your office. Obviously, we have a third cost to be calculated, and that is the labor cost, what you pay your workers. The labor cost is the only real variable in the bidding process. And I would like to emphasize that. that out of all the different things that must be calculated when a construction project is bid, the only real variable is the labor. And because construction contracts are traditionally awarded to the lowest bidder, when there is no standard that must be paid to workers, such as is established with Davis-Bacon, it becomes a race to the bottom. Whoever can pay their workers the least is the winner because they're awarded the contract. Therefore, I feel that having a standard that must be paid to employees, such as Davis-Bacon, helps not only the workers, but it helps ensure that the construction projects go to responsible contractors and not just the winner of a race to the bottom bidding process. Therefore, I'm here today to urge you to please leave this law alone and please oppose House Bill 155. Thank you for your time and your consideration today.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Larry Bell.
Mr. Chairman and other members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Larry Bell. I'm here representing three kids, a second-generation family of Alaskans, residents of Wasilla, and also have the distinguished pleasure of representing almost 8,000 active and retired members of the IBEW Local 1547. I want to state my animate opposition to House Bill 155 today for a number of reasons. One, it's not good for a floor to wage earning potential for working Alaskans, as was just demonstrated by Mr. Fry. It's not good for local Alaskan hire. It's not good for seasonally employed Alaskans in the construction industry. It's not good for the quality and ensuring that quality on construction efforts on state-funded projects. I would simply implore this committee to leave this bill alone. House Bill 155 ensures that employment on public-funded jobs focus on efficiency and the ability to do the job right and effectively. And that's all I have. Are there any questions?
Thanks again for joining us. I think we've got time for one more. Sean Cross. Are you with us, Sean?
Here it comes. I'm just here to support.
Oh, could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
My name is Sean Cross, S-H-A-W-N-C-R-O-S-S. I am an apprentice for the IBEW Local 1547. And I'm here to support the ideas of my local union and and oppose House Bill 155. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us, and I would like to apologize to all the people that we haven't got to today. We're certainly not in a position to close out public testimony, and we'll be taking again later this week. And again, I apologize if we didn't get to you. I think we had probably close to 55 people signed up today. And with that, we will adjourn at 4:55.